Hey everyone, and welcome back to Hyphen in Hollywood, Hyphen Magazine's exclusive entertainment podcast. My name is Christian Thiem, contributing editor on the film and TV culture beat, and I'm joined by a very special guest, Lacey Lou Nguyen Wright, associate director of Build Power. Lacey, how's it going?
Hi, thanks for bringing me in to chat.
Oh, you're very welcome. For our viewers tuning in, if you might hear some background noise, yes, I am recording from inside the back of my car with Lacey. Don't worry, we're wearing masks, but we figured to do a very DIY impromptu session, one on the heels of the end of APA Heritage Month, but also in light of recent events to cover today. So let's get started. So Lacey, again, just to check in, how are you doing?
That is the most loaded question anyone has ever asked me. I'm really tired. I was out almost all of yesterday. We helped plan yesterday's protest and march, and as I'm sure I'll talk about later, we got shoved around by the cops several times. And I think in the moment there was a lot of adrenaline that wore off by this morning, so Definitely a very sore body, but I'm doing better. Today's been a new day.
Yeah, and just for our viewers tuning in, and if whenever you receive this episode and whenever you listen, we're speaking again coming off the heels of the Los Angeles protest that took place on Saturday, May 30th, here in the middle of LA in Fairfax. Lacey was among many protesters really standing in opposition in the front line and the recipient of a lot of complex and a lot of unfair discrimination and affronts. So just to kind of kick things off for our viewers too, can you share with us the extent of your involvement specifically with the protests in LA yesterday?
Yeah, so I am, as you mentioned earlier, the associate director of Build Power. It's a nonprofit initiative started by Kendrick Sampson, who's both an actor and an activist. And the main mission of our organization is to increase liberation culture within Hollywood. And part of the way we do that is, look, as we are in Hollywood, we're storytellers, we're artists, as well as activists. And I think it's so important because what we know how to do best is to create narratives and tell stories that resonate with people. So we partner influencers, radical academics, actors, activists, together with grassroots organizations to help amplify their messages and the work that they're doing. And there's no time more crucial than that. Then during this time after following the death of George Floyd and so many other Black folks who've been murdered by the cops.
Yeah, and it was evident as an individual who also attended the protest in the beginning as well and towards the eventual conclusion, just the extent that Build Power operates and its visibility and again the branding of it in the context of these protests. At the beginning of Pan Pacific Park, it was very clear the connection that Build Power has as a hub of information resources, in many ways empowerment, and the ideology that is designed to be disseminated among groups to give them the right vocalizations and the right tools to be equipped to handle not just in the protesting context but in daily life. And I think that's something that in many ways is absent from a larger campaigns that have been out there and that have been kind of getting a lot of traction. So its unique form and structure, I think, is very, again, just impressive in the context of what it's been doing. So we as a community really appreciate your work, although I've told you this countless times. And in regards to your work, what did you hope to achieve via the protest? And heading into it and even perhaps during it, did you have any reservations about how things would pan out? I mean, you know, in light of everything that happened today and how that kind of was informed as the protest went on Saturday?
Yeah, I mean, we're also protesting during a pandemic.
Yeah.
So in a normal day, in a normal year, if there's ever been such a thing as a normal year, I would have told everyone and their mothers that you need to be out there. You need to support. We all need to stand together in solidarity, especially being an Asian American, working for a really well-known and radical Black activist who has, you know, suffered at the hands of the cops before. It was so important that we show up for solidarity and for our communities and for our collective liberation. But I did know by asking people to come out that we were putting everyone at risk COVID-wise. And that was something that definitely weighed on me, is knowing like how much of a risk are we taking with this?
Especially given the just the statistical sort of facts regarding the percentage of African-American and Latinx communities that tend to index higher in terms of infection rates, in terms of access to healthcare. So I can imagine that you felt some type of moral quandary in terms of, like, is this ethically a good decision to be present here too? So I can imagine, like, that back and forth that you kind of maintain, you know, heading into all this.
Absolutely. But we held it at Pan Pacific Park, which, for those who are not from LA, is on the west side of LA, which is a predominantly white neighborhood. It's adjacent to Beverly Hills. Pan Pacific Park is next to the Grove, one of the nicest shopping centers in Los Angeles. Yeah. And the point of it, you know, it was two things. It was one, we need to confront people with this message. And privilege at the end of the day is choice. And so there are so many people in this world who have the choice to ignore this. You can go your whole life and not ever need to hear George Floyd's name and never even consider what he went through, or, you know, the circumstances and systemic oppression that killed him. Mm-hmm. Some people have that privilege. And so what we wanted was to do it somewhere where we could reach the people who are most likely to ignore what's going on, but also to make it more accessible to allies to come into this space. As you said, like, Black and brown folks have been dying of COVID at higher rates.
Yeah.
They're also the majority of the essential workers, which previously was called unskilled labor, and have put their bodies on the line now to fight for justice. And I think it was very important that we bring this fight to the west side of LA and to these communities and bring in other folks from the west side.
Yeah, and I think probably the most telling imagery in regards to that was seeing this dichotomy between, I think it was very vividly, it was captured, I think, on USA Today, of a bunch of protesters, largely people of color, walking in one direction, and two white guys with caramel macchiatos walking the opposite direction. In many ways, a combination of indifference or aloofness or just uncaring. And
that was what was shocking, is we had thousands of people walking down 3rd
thousands,
Street
yeah.
by the Grove, and there were people who were watching and filming from the Grove while eating their food or just watching. And I was like, why are you not out here in the streets with us? The only people I give a pass was the healthcare center we walked by, and all of the nurses came out to wave at us.
Yeah.
But that was kind of the larger purpose, is people want, we're clearly not being heard about police brutality. And I spoke with Patrice Cullors, who's one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. back after the death of Trayvon Martin, the murder of Trayvon Martin. And it felt, this time feels so weird, because I think Black Lives Matter has made such a huge national impact, and is one of the most, and is the most important movement of the past decade, if not the past 50 years.
Absolutely.
But you can look at the death of George Floyd and sometimes just think, has anything changed at all? Has anything we have done made a difference? And I think people are feeling that desperation and feeling that injustice, and wanted and needed a space to vocalize it.
Yeah, and their anger and their outrage is completely justified. And I think just being in the crowd, even towards the beginning, just the latent sense just that is just so palpable, that, you know, qualifies this hurt. And then qualifies this idea that there is no clear answer. And you asked, you know, has anything changed since the time of Trayvon Martin, rest in power? I think our anger has. I also think that the influx of social media has played a deeply consequential role in the dissemination of both information, resources, but also fear mongering, also false news, also any type of misinformation that has redirected people's focus or distracted them from the wider aim. And we're seeing it happen right now on Twitter and all different platforms.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, in regards to your role in the protest today, from camera footage captured directly from private Instagrams to public figures, you were near the front of the protesters when the escalation began. Again, you know, I know this is all very fresh. We're recording literally less than a day after things happen. At your own comfort, can you just provide, like, a recap of, like, what exactly happened there that may not be covered in by mainstream media?
Yeah. I mean, I think people forget the beginning of this was at Pan Pacific Park, and we rooted this in unity, in liberation, and in resistance, but it was incredibly peaceful. And I went into this really hoping, just praying that this was going to be a peaceful day, because I think that's entirely possible. I think people wanted to gather together in solidarity. Mm-hmm. So we did this beautiful rally in the park. We poured libations and said the names of everyone we have lost to police brutality over the past few years. We spoke of what we wanted next from people, which was to get involved, which was to donate, which was to be vocal. At no point did we ever call for violence. And while I understand the anger people have that created the lashing out, from what we were trying to organize, we are trying to focus and organize around hope, hope that there can be a better future.
Yeah.
And we marched from Pan Pacific Park to 3rd and Fairfax.
Yeah.
And I had actually lost, the crowd had gotten so big, I had lost track of Kendrick. And so I had left to go find him.
And how'd you find him?
I checked his IG live. And what had happened basically was the crowd had gotten so big that they had kept on marching even after Kendrick had closed out the march. And so when I went back to find him, the cops had already arrived and split up the crowd. And this was clearly a concerted effort to break up and disperse people. But people who, again, were marching peacefully. Yes, we were blocking a street. Yes, we were confronting people, you know, at their workshops and at their businesses. But it was entirely peaceful. And the point was to make sure our message was heard. And they were there to break it up. And so they split everyone into two groups. And they, the cops had lined up with batons riot gear pointed straight at us. And we got to the front lines, and I have never been so terrified.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
They asked us to take a step back, and we said we had every reason to be there, and we were allowed to be there, and we did not fight back, we didn't push back, we were not trying to be aggressive, we were screaming,
mm-hmm.
but we were not shoving, we didn't touch anybody.
Yeah.
And the cops asked us to take a step back. We said we wouldn't. And instead of, you know, if they want, and here's the thing, if they had wanted us to clear out and just step back, they could have brought out a wall of shields and just pushed us back. Mm-hmm. They were there to escalate and to hurt us. And that's the thing is, I'm not saying that we should respond in violence, but when they came at us with violence, they were escalating it. And I'm not surprised that people responded violently.
Absolutely.
And so I was there, and especially as we talk about, like, for Asian Americans, we need to be standing in solidarity. I wanted to make sure that our bodies were on the front and that allies were at the front as well.
Mm-hmm.
Until the cops started swinging batons at us. Yeah. And Kendrick and his assistant Mario, who is a saint of a human, made a point to make sure I stood behind them and always check where I was. And they took the brunt of the hits.
Mm-hmm.
They hit Mario so hard. He had a gash in his shin and we could see his bone. We had to rush him to urgent care. You know, they shot Kendrick right in the chest and they were shooting us with rubber bullets. And normally, not that that ever should be allowed in general, but you shoot rubber bullets at the ground. They're very loud. They flashbang you and then they'll projectile into the air. They shot it right at our feet. They were trying to hit us.
Yeah.
They had no intention of trying to peacefully de-escalate. There was no time that they were trying to get the a peaceful crowd to disperse. They were there to rile people up and make them angry. There is no point where LAPD was trying to ever de-escalate that situation. They came in there with an intention.
It was militarized. It was violent. It represented, you know, a very direct and a very singular objective from their end, which in many ways is, you know, one, it's reprehensible that from the litany of eyewitnesses who were present on site, seeing it go literally 0 to 100 for no other reason outside of them wanting to disperse this protest, it's infuriating. It represents in many ways just a loss of trust within the system. But I also think it's a very important reminder of why we do this to begin with. What is the essence of our engagement here to be seen, to be heard, and to be mobilized the way that we did? So I really just want to say, like, I'm happy you're safe. Even though people were injured, things could have been truly a lot worse. But for you to be there, like, witnessing that firsthand must have been an ordeal.
No, it was unnerving. And it was also, that's also, like, what you said is making me so angry, is that the reason we protest to get out there is people don't protest. Like, we didn't all wake up one morning and decide to start a riot.
Yeah.
It's, people come out to protest and to mobilize, especially that many people came out during a pandemic when we all know that was unsafe of us to do, is because we feel like we have no other way to vocalize our anger and our frustration. And what the LAPD is saying when they come at us like that is you don't have that right. You do not have the right to be angry, to want to mobilize, to want to be vocal. Your opinions do not have a space here. That is the direct message that they're sending us.
Yeah.
And then they're shocked that right after they started pushing back on us, the cop car got set on fire.
Mm-hmm.
They tear gassed people.
Yeah.
Tear gas is a war crime. U.S. military, certain divisions are not allowed to use tear gas.
Yeah.
But they can use that on a peaceful crowd.
And it's just, it's abhorrent knowing that, you know, when they fired tear gas at us, I remember very distinctly seeing, like, a European family on the corner within maybe 10, 15 feet of one of the canisters. There was no discrimination as to who was the intended target for this. They were completely agnostic to pain and suffering. And it's just, again, a travesty on a bunch of different levels, but I want to kind of bring it back to you again. You have a background in civic engagement and were at least seen as a authority in this space. The one common commentary about the protests in Fairfax, LA was the presence and the over-representation of white protesters, but also a lot of performative allyship as well. So I'd love to get your kind of advice on what type of guidance would you give non-black, non-POC protesters on what their role is truly, you know, within the span of a protest?
Well, firstly, you just said I was an authority on the subject. One, I'm definitely not, absolutely not. And two, authority is the worst word you have picked.
Well, edit it out.
But I have a couple thoughts on this. I think social media has, I'm 23, I don't know what I'm talking about, but social media has definitely changed the way we can protest. I mean, for one, because I've spoken with organizers who, you know, have worked in the 60s back, you know, along with, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., and they, you know, they're in awe of what we can pull off because we can disseminate information faster. Can we think about the thousands of people we pulled together? I think we planned that 2 days in advance, maybe. We were genuinely unsure the day before how many people we were going to get out. We did not think we were going to get as many as we did. And I think especially during COVID, I know a lot of people who really wanted to come out who couldn't come out because they're immunocompromised. They have family that's immunocompromised. Some people can't come out because they have work. And that's true of every protest.
Yeah.
And there is something powerful about social media that makes these spaces now more accessible, that more people can be in the space with me, that more people can watch, that more people can understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. And now also we don't have to necessarily rely on certain media outlets to tell the stories that we want to. Yeah. It has democratized it. At the same time, it's also meant a lot of people going to prove, like, as if taking the photo at the rally means that you're down with the cause. And protesting is not activism. It is one avenue of activism. And it is the first step in what needs to be a series of actions that support a cause. And for something like this, I think, you know, a lot of people's first marches was the Women's March after 2016, which was organized by women of color and was a really beautiful movement. But it was also very peaceful. And so many people who have not been to other protests before don't realize how violent they can get or what police will do to target you.
Yeah.
If you're taking protest selfies, if you're live streaming and filming, that is what the cops use to identify people. Mm-hmm. That is what happened at Standing Rock. They used social media to identify who was there and to arrest people.
Yeah.
So your protest selfie can put people at risk. And I don't think most people know that.
Inadvertently as well. Just people caught in the background or, you know, within the spaces, visible.
Right. If you are there, you should be taking pictures of the cops. You should be taking pictures
of
instigators. You should be capturing what is wrong because, yes, we need that footage. But to take photos and put people at risk just so you can prove your level of wokeness is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And it's great that we're seeing so many allies out. But you need to go into these with understanding. But that's also, to a degree, it is also okay because protesting is a skill.
Mm-hmm.
I think I saw that yesterday. Like, you have to be trained to take a beating. Kendrick knew what to do.
Oh,
I was not ready. I absolutely chickened out. As someone who's been very vocal about we need to put our bodies and we need to put ourselves on the line alongside our brothers and sisters, I absolutely chickened out and I let someone else take a hit for me. And I'm not proud of that. Mm-hmm. But it's also, it's a skill, and I think people love to point out to other protests going on in the world right now. Like, South Korea impeached their president in a very peaceful manner.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a lot of some, not all, but peaceful protests in Hong Kong, things like that, it's because they've been trained, it's because they know what they're doing, because they've done this time and time again, that they know what tactics work and do not.
Right.
So in these times, we need to look specifically to Black leaders who have been doing this work for decades for leadership in this.
I think it's a very good point, and I think on the topic of, like, Black public leadership as well, you know, we've seen a lot of celebrities and public figures effectively come out of the woodwork to express their opinions on the issues. These range from passive regramming photos to going on live streams to having dialogues with the communities. Your boss, Kendrick, a Black man, is a bit of an anomaly in this space and in this sense. Can you just talk about how Kendrick's learned approach and leaned-in approach to activism has influenced, or perhaps have you influenced by, your personal involvement, and what advice you would give to other public figures or any people with platforms on how to use those responsibly?
Reach out to build power. I will help you. That is what I do for a living.
Indeed.
No, I...
He's radical.
I am truly a fan of Kendrick, and I will defend that boy till the end. And I think at his core, he believes in liberation, and that is why I've worked for him. What he wants is to uplift grassroots organizations. What he wants to fight for is liberation. Yeah. And every avenue that he takes must serve that. And I think that is why we first got along. We met, I used to be a creative artist agency, which is a talent agency that represents him. And we have a foundation team that is amazing, and they advise a lot of the clients on their social impact strategies, ways they can be involved, and to facilitate a lot of this sort of organizing. And that's how we first met.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in Hollywood, the way people vet whether something's a good opportunity is what company or organization is behind it. How profile is that? Is that high profile enough for their client? And when I was vetting things for him, the only thing he cared about is how much of an impact is my involvement going to make? How much can I apply? What is the work that they are doing? And how do we strategically get that message out there? And that's, again, where he brings in, he is a storyteller, he's an artist, he's an activist. He's very focused on how do we tell the narratives that need to be shared. And that's why I worked for him. And I think it's because he has really taken the time. I mean, he's been on the ground doing this work for a long time. He was at Standing Rock. He has taken trips to the border to meet with Black migrants. Like, he has done so much work. So he has such a deep understanding of this work that I think is why so many people look to him as a leader. And he's not doing this in any performative sense. That's why we saw he was on the front lines taking a beating.
Yeah.
Because he knew where we need to be in that situation.
I think that, you know, not all celebrities and public figures will reach the level of cognizance and care that Kendrick does. And a common sentiment that I've seen expressed within my own networks and my friends and public figures that I know is this sense of analysis paralysis regarding how to properly leverage channels, information sharing, any type of media for the sake of a good cause. A lot of times people have felt stifled or personally silenced, like this helicopter is doing to me right now.
Oh, good Lord,
another
right?
One. It's right up in the corner. Yeah, it doesn't get as real as this, people.
Last night, it took me so long to fall asleep. One, same. Because I could not stop hearing the gunshots go off in my head. There were so many helicopters that went over my building.
Yeah.
And also because we live near each other along the 101, so we just heard cars going by all last night.
Yeah. It's a bit much. But again, just to this idea of people feeling like paralyzed in regarding what activism, what shape does it take in this day and age when a person feels like, hey, this same information pamphlet has been shared on Instagram stories enough. Does my contribution mean something? Is it inconsequential? Am I over spamming people? How does, like, I don't know, it's a big social question, but like, how does a mind kind of navigate the feeling, the sentiment of like, am I doing enough? Am I doing too much? What the role is in a type of social upheaval like this?
I mean, I think there's two things. I mean, to start at the beginning of this question, in terms of influencers, that is why we started Build Power. Is post 2016, everyone wants to get involved. I think I'm sad that this is what it took, but Donald Trump showed everyone how deeply rooted racism is in our country.
Yeah.
And exposed a lot of the systemic oppression that activists have been talking about for years,
mm-hmm.
but we're not getting traction on. And I think that was the why Kendrick started Build Power, was to educate folks. So as if you want to be in this work,
right,
that's great and you should be, but we need to give you the tools to do it best.
Right.
So that way, you know, if you have a platform, especially folks who have millions of followers or are musicians or artists that reach people, you do have a responsibility, especially when people are looking to you for leadership.
Exactly.
On a personal level, I don't think there is ever doing too much or not... There's not doing enough, but I also don't want people to be too hard on themselves that they're not doing enough in this space. I think it's easy to see how awful the world is, and there's always something more you could be fighting for. There's always something more you could be doing. And then sometimes people then are, you know, are paralyzed in those moments. I think more than anything, people should recognize that every little thing they do makes a difference. And I think that's something beautiful that has come out of COVID, is people are realizing that even if you're making food for your neighbors, even if you're picking up groceries, it's mutual aid.
Yeah.
All the small things you do make an impact. And when we teach activism, especially when we teach it in elementary and high schoolers, middle schoolers, you know, in K-12, it's all about Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, and it's about individual people.
Yeah.
And while they are great, I'm not discounting them, movements are not built by single people. They are built by thousands of people and millions of people collectively coming together, each doing different actions in the way that they can do it best. The best thing you can do is make food. Is the best things you can do is that you have, you know, a platform to speak on. Use what you have.
Yeah.
I think there isn't such a thing as doing too much, but there is something, again, about who we are looking to and who we are amplifying, and that is something that I'm very particular on. And again,
absolutely,
you want to know how to protest, you want to know who to fight for. We need to look to the people who are doing this work on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people have been reaching out to Kendrick and me saying, how can they support Build Power, how can they support our work? And we were like, we don't want it. Go help,
being picky.
Go help Black Lives Matter LA, go help Students Deserve, go, you know, join White People for Black Lives. Like, these are the organizations that are doing work directly on the ground. Go to help reform LA jails, go to the bail funds that are trying to get people out of prisons.
Yeah.
And jails, that is who we need to support, and we should look to them as leaders because they have been doing this work. Yesterday's rally was with us, Malina Abdullah, who's the head of Black Lives Matter LA, and Patrice Cullors, who's been doing this work. She's only 32. No, older than that, 36. But she's been doing this work for decades now and was one of the national co-founders of Black Lives Matter. If I don't know what to do next, I'm looking to her.
Yeah.
What is she asking people to do? Because she has seen what's effective and not. You know, as we were saying, like, not everyone knows how to approach it, and that's okay. You need to learn and you need to grow. But remember, we need to turn to people who have done this before.
Exactly. And just for our readership and for our viewers, we'll make sure to include all affiliate links and organizations in the bio within the media around this promotional push for this episode, so that you have, as an individual, empowered resources that you can look up and do the time. Because let's be real, everyone's got time right now. Everyone's got time to just lean in intentionally and do the work. And I think a misnomer that we have to dispel as activists is that it's so much more than just passionate rhetoric and big fancy words. It's about the record. It's about doing the actual work. It's about showing up. It's about, you know, putting your money where your mouth is. It's about being an advocate even when it's uncomfortable. And I think for Kendrick, I've admired him, that we talked about a lot, but in many ways, in terms of an intersectional solidarity, you mentioned earlier about how Build Power has had a role within the Asian American activist movement within entertainment in regards to Oscar So White and a lot of things that have happened, you know, in acknowledgement of this being the last day of APA Heritage Month. I'd love to kind of hear how that was forged even before your involvement, just less than a year ago. And again, what do you think is the value of that intersectional solidarity right now for Asian Americans?
Yeah. I mean, for Asian Americans, especially, this is Asian Pacific American Heritage Month.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in these spaces, we need to understand our history. And that's not just, again, uplifting the great activists we have had in our world and all of the, you know, amazing people who have helped move. Because I think people forget Asian Americans have been oppressed for a long time in this country. And it's not a history we teach. Japanese internment, the Chinese Exclusion Act, also the decades and decades of incarceration of Southeast Asians, the treatment of refugees in this country. But also, when we are complicit in police brutality and black oppression, you know, people are very scared in LA right now. There's a curfew.
Like right now, actually. So we're
But and the last time this was happened was the Rodney King riots in 1992. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, we call them the Rodney King riots. But I think people forget one of the precursors to that only a few weeks earlier was the death of Latasha Harlins.
Yeah.
Which was a Korean shop owner who shot a black girl unnecessarily in the shop. And the role that is played. And then also not to mention the role of Total in the death of George Floyd.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's a huge Hmong community in Minnesota. And that while he may not have been the one on George's neck, he was still pushing people away. He was still preventing people from stepping into that situation. He was still using his platform as a cop.
He was complicit.
Completely complicit.
Yeah.
And even yesterday, the cop who was standing in front of me was Korean.
Hmm.
It was so jarring to me to see another Asian American face staring at me and knowing that they were not my allies or they were not in my community. But it's also, even though I don't feel like they were in my community, we have to claim these people. Like, we can't say, like, oh, they're not really Asian, they're not really one of us, because there is so much anti-blackness within our community.
100%.
And we need to recognize that. At the same time, we also need to recognize our own oppression. I think also because the Asian American community is huge, and it's not, you know, a monolith, and mm-hmm. it's diverse, that we face these oppressions too.
Yeah.
You know, they think they show that, like, Asian American youth are twice as likely to be tried as adults than white folks. Of this, you know, white youth of the same age, that there's huge gang violence in Southeast Asian communities, and most of the Asian folks in prisons are from refugees communities.
Yeah.
So if you're Laotian, Cambodian, Vietnamese, you know, where gang violence is rampant in our communities, like, we are being arrested and also deported too. There's been a huge number of deportations under Trump. And I think there's something, if you're in this country and you're not indigenous, you came here for a reason. And for a lot of us, we were fleeing things. You know, I'm Vietnamese American. My grandfather was the founder of the National Progressive Movement, which, you know, fought against the communist government in Vietnam. My family fled as refugees. If you're Asian American and you have come here because you were fleeing some sort of oppression, you and your families and your forefathers know what state violence looks like. So how can you not stand by and be supportive of our black and brown communities as they're being oppressed in the situation? We need to have that allyship.
Yeah. And the way, and again, I appreciate you saying that too, and again, for sharing your personal history, which is completely valid and relevant. You know, we've seen allyship, you know, take the form of direct support from the API community in regards to Black Lives Matter and supporting George Floyd's family. We've also seen acknowledgement from figures in our community of the undeniable impact that Black culture and activism has on our respective histories. It's just the tricky subject regarding the presence of Asians in the police. I know we've captured from the officer involved in George Floyd's death to recently viral videos from the San Jose Police Department of an officer by the name of Jared Yuen, clearly trigger happy, clearly being present to cause inside violence in San Jose. It's a complicated nature because in many ways, the visual of an Asian officer is such a conflation to Asians' proximity with whiteness and white authority, this sublimation of identity to be accepted. And the implications of that are very complex and problematic. Because many of us, even as like East Asian privileged individuals like myself, actively try to disavow our correlation, our tendencies to be aligned with that model minority myth. And so, you know, a lot of Asian Americans who I've talked to recently in my community have expressed a complication of identity regarding right now, you know, for a lot of them who either don't have a lot of black friends or don't have friends of color outside Asians, about what that paradigm is in terms of like their voice. Because for the longest time, the Asian activist voice they've always felt like was in relation to something else. We're looking to see right now what the modern one, in full acknowledgement of our recent discrimination because of the coronavirus that we've experienced, which, if in all honesty, is but a smidgen of the oppression experienced by black and brown bodies. What counsel would you give viewers who are just looking to have some sort of framework of what that's going to look like for their future?
The framework of solidarity?
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, I think going back to your point about COVID is mm-hmm. that, You know, a lot of us, you know, we have talked about this, about how people look at us, especially at the beginning of COVID, thinking that we were the ones that caused COVID, the harassment we've taken. You know, families were attacked in Texas, an old woman was attacked in New York. We have seen Asian restaurants vandalized everywhere, specifically in the Bay Area. It was like three Lee sandwiches and a boba shop and somewhere else. If you, and I think we're hearing this especially for older Americans, if you suddenly feel like your presence is a threat, people are perceiving you as a threat, now you know what it is like every single day for Black and brown folks in this country.
Yep.
You know, if you've never understood that, like, it, again, should not have taken a pandemic to understand and to build this solidarity. But it gives you a glimpse into what living every day as a Black person is like. And I think we ignore the level of trauma that and the toll this takes on people's mental health.
Yeah.
Not just the rallies, not just the protests yesterday, but also living like that every day, having, you know, growing up in a police state. LA School's police department is the largest school police department in the country.
Mm.
There is a school to prison pipeline because the schools are basically functioning like prisons to start with. They are designed like prisons, and they have more cops than therapists on site. Terrible. We are criminalizing people from the beginning. And so from there, everything you do, everything you do can be activism. And like you said, where you spend your dollars, who you reach out to, who you're studying, who you look to for leadership can be an act of activism. And I think it's important in these moments to make sure that we're letting Black and brown folks lead this movement.
Absolutely. Let's talk about mobilization. It's been reported in the 2010 census that Asian Americans are the fastest growing minority in America. They represent over $1 trillion in consumer buying power in 2018. Established Asian Americans who are on the front line are on the verge of an undeniable, influential buying power and clout in the United States. At this critical juncture, how do we mobilize in a manner that's direct, intentional, and effective? Is it leveraging our privilege when it comes to economic prosperity? Is it supporting Black-owned businesses? What's kind of like the first steps that we would take, knowing that we possess this tremendous potential as a consumer and cultural power?
Fund everything. If we have the money, I can send you all the links of every bail fund in the country, every organization that is working to decarcerate and abolish the police state. But I think we also need to remember, like, yes, we are one of the fastest growing, we are the fastest growing minority group, quote unquote minority, in the country. We're also the fastest growing undocumented community.
Mm.
You know, we are also, and I think when you average out our community, yes, we are more financially well off. Yes, we do have a lot of privileges, but we also have so many vulnerable folks in our communities. Like, let's talk about COVID and the rates of domestic violence and how many folks are stuck at home with abusers and the rates of domestic violence in our homes that we need to address. And again, collective liberation means when we help one of us, we are helping all of us, and that uplifting, we can uplift all of us together. I think there is something, and that's what, I mean, this might be going back to the earlier question, but working for Kendrick has been so interesting to me. Because like you said, we do have a certain level of privilege. When Kendrick speaks out about something and he's angry or impassioned, which he has a right to be, he is an angry Black man, automatically. When I speak out, people don't take me seriously as much. I'm small, I'm young, you know, it's, and we don't imagine Asian American activists. So there's a lot of times I've either been infantilized or dismissed. And there are definitely times when each of us, what makes us such a great team, the reason we work together well, is we have different modes and theories of change. I am very much an introvert. I do not like a bullhorn. I do not like leading rallies. I don't like protests in terms of, I don't like that many people near me. Can the revolution start from my couch?
Yeah.
But you'll see that sometimes in the way that we'll operate. You know, people may not take me seriously. People may not listen to me if I'm speaking out. So he will say it, and people will listen. And some people will dismiss him because he's just a loud, angry Black man they assume is uneducated, doesn't know anything. And I can say the same thing. And because people have certain assumptions about Asian Americans, which are, may not be true, but they think, oh, I must be smart. Oh, I must be well-educated. Oh, I must, you know, I'm, you know, I'm more grounded in this situation and they'll listen to me.
Yeah.
And so that's where in some ways we use both our own oppression and privileges for each other's advantage. And that is allyship, I think, yeah. at the end of the day. And I think that's something so important to focus on, is like something that, you know, I'm not considered threatening and I'm not taken seriously. That is both a privilege and oppression now. That is both something I can use for good and something that silences me. And I think we need to focus on that. Like, it's not an oppression Olympics of who has it worse or who has it better, but how can we use all the tools that we have together in our toolbox, bring them together to fight for collective liberation?
Yeah. Well, for the record, you've scared me since the beginning I met you. So that can be kind of a part of your cultural subversion. You know, you know, I think that's such a great segue, you know, in a lot of the issues discussed, and again, just for a readership, we know this is a heavy topic, but that's exactly why we're bringing it to the table today. Your relationship with Kendrick, as an Asian woman and him as a Black man, you know, it'd be remiss for us not to mention the profound and rich history of intersectional collaboration of the Asian and Black communities in America since our inception. You know, this connection in our communities is present within the revolutionary text and activism of the late Grace Lee Boggs, Rest in Power, to Richard Aoki, to the immortalization of that within the visual of Yuri Kochiyama holding Malcolm X. Our historical ties are largely ignored by modern American texts, which again is a problem that you addressed earlier. It's the powerful reminder of the legacy that's been charted before us as young activists. You know, I've asked you a lot of questions about advice, directions, instructions. Let's flip it. What's your hope for the next generation of leaders in our community? And who are some people doing the work right now that may not have the visibility or platform that they should?
That's a big question.
I know.
But I like what you're going for when you say, like, what is my hope? Because that is something that also we talk a lot about in our work in Build Power in terms of the role of Hollywood, because... Mm-hmm. What we will allow ourselves to believe as a community is so ingrained in Hollywood, because what we're willing to show in movies and TV shows affects people's collective imagination. So when we talk about things like abolishing prisons, Medicare for all these progressive policies that have seem radical,
yeah,
we need to be speaking out about that in Hollywood and in our narrative so we believe it's possible. Do I think that we're going to be able to dismantle the prison system by the time I die? Probably not. But it takes someone like Kendrick to demand a bigger, bolder vision so we can start believing that it's possible and we can start working towards it.
Yeah.
And also, if he's being loud out there, demanding these huge, big, bold changes and bringing people to believe that, it also makes it easier for other actors to say, like, you can mess with him or you can mess with us.
Right.
And they can bring the policy points that maybe are more incrementalist, but are still the steps we need. How many, you know, and I think that's something I bring up a lot is, this work is so hard.
Yeah.
Every day it's hard on your body and your mind. And I mean literally hard on your body. Yesterday was rough.
Yeah.
But you need to celebrate your victories no matter how small or big they are. You know, we need to celebrate that we have gotten so many folks released from prison, which because of the pandemic, because we couldn't have, you cannot socially distance in a prison. So they've released a lot of older folks, high at-risk folks, folks who are going to be released soon anyway. And that is not enough. That is not by any means enough. No one should be in prison.
Yeah.
There is no point. But that we can celebrate these smaller victories. I do hope for a world where we have greater intersectional activism between all communities. And that's not just like Black, Asian, Latinx, but how often are we including intersections in the queer community? How often, again, like speaking to the accessibility of these movements,
yeah.
folks with disabilities or folks, you know, you can't be out there if you have epilepsy, you can't be flash banged by the yeah. cops. Like, not every action is accessible to all. So to make sure that when we are looking to build power, that we are including everyone.
This belief of an accessible revolution.
Absolutely.
Yeah. A revolution in a literal sense, in a psychological and a cultural sense. It's all tied together. It's very powerful. And again, who are some people in the community that you would want to highlight that deserve, you know, additional limelight?
Yeah. I mean, I've talked so much about the oppression of Asian American prisoners. Eddie Zhang, who's the leader of the Asian prison.
Yep.
Yes. Love him. I'm going to say this right. Asian Prisoner Support Committee, who has done so much work for Asian American communities, especially men in prison. Danae Joseph, who has been an idol of mine from the get-go. She was an activist on the ground at UCLA doing student activism together back in the day with me. And she is one of she came here as an undocumented child from Belize, I think when she was 3. Mm-hmm. And she has done so much for the undocumented Black community. And then also need to give a shout out to Carmen Rojas, who just took over as the head of the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I think something we also need to think about is going back to, we talk about Asian American wealth that a lot of us have. She is head of a foundation that I think right now is like $800 million in assets. And the thing about philanthropy is you only need to spend 5%, or you only need to disperse 5% of your total assets each year. We're in the middle of a pandemic. There is no point that money should be locked away anywhere in a bank. Fuck your endowment. We Amen. Need to spend that money. We need to give it out. And Carmen Rojas has been so vocal as a Latina who has used all of her platform and work within the philanthropy community to make sure money is getting to the hands of people of color. I think everyone wants to give to charities, and so many folks are giving money, which is important, absolutely.
Yeah.
But actually, when you look at funding and grant money, I think it's less than 15% actually ends up in the hands of communities of color.
That's not good. Yeah.
So the work that she's doing to make sure that money is going to families of color is so crucial. And I think it's an aspect we forget. I think with charity, sometimes people think, oh, I gave money, and you just have trust in other people that it's going to the right place. And like, we need to be critical of who we're supporting, who are we giving money to, who do they give money to?
Yeah.
And so she's someone that I really want to highlight.
I think accountability is also its own revolution as well. We have the resources as individuals, as participants in the internet, to track the money, see where things go, take receipts, take screenshots, like our friend Rachel, like everything.
take receipts in the group chat,
because it's all consequential, it's all relevant, it's all going to come in handy someday too. So, you know, we've spoken, and again, I really appreciate you taking the time in the middle of our curfew. Hopefully we won't be flagged out when we leave her today, but we've spoken at length, giving advice, instruction, hope to our viewers. The intent of these conversations isn't to give you some pamphlet, some toolkit of things. It's to remind you that empowerment is always within reach, and that in many respects, from my own experiences, to be encouraged to find the lane of activism that's your flavor, that's your passion. You know, for myself, like as someone who is a stutter, I've always looked at like ableist and ableism as a space where I can make my impact for communities that struggle with empowerment on a linguistic level. For Asian Americans, our community is so rich and so diverse, and it just, the hope is that you find the idiosyncrasies and the nuances of your community and your identity that you can stay claim with, because that power that you can build is always within reach too. So I know we spoke a lot. Lastly, you are someone who holds a lot of hats in this world, and even now, knowing you for as long as I have, I always wonder, how do you do it? You know, how do you do it, and how do you juggle it all with intense purpose? So the last question is, how does a person like you, and how does a person take a step back from the noise and the cacophony of the world and practice self-care? What do you like doing that helps alleviate this burden that we feel?
My self-care, and I do a thing, and I start off every community meeting that I put together with, everyone has to tell me their latest victory. And that goes back to my earlier point that we do need to celebrate the wins that we have. I don't think we're going to reach liberation. I don't think we'd reach equity, even fucking equality, during my lifetime. But I have to keep fighting like we can. And every day we need to celebrate the wins that we have made, so we can keep believing that there will be more. If we do not acknowledge what we have done well, and you know what? It can be a small win. Yesterday's win was we got thousands of people out.
Yes, you did.
To show that we stand in solidarity with the Black community, to show that we will not stand for the injustice that was done to George Floyd, to Nina Pop, to Breonna Taylor, to everybody who has been ruthlessly killed by the cops unnecessarily. Your win could also be like, I made a phenomenal latte this morning. I have finally perfected the milk frothing technique using coffee made from a really, really radical, small, Latino-owned coffee shop. There are wins at every single level. Everything you do makes an impact on someone else, whether or not you realize. The TV shows that you watch, where you're spending your money, what you're posting, who you're communicating with, who you're checking in on today. And I think we need to bring that level of intention to everything we do in this world. And I think when you celebrate the wins, you celebrate you can keep having hope. And I think that is my self-care, is because every day it feels like there's something worse and worse every single day. We have a Cheeto for a president. We're watching people die across the country. We're watching state violence, not just in the U.S., but in Hong Kong right now, in so many countries. You have to keep celebrating what we have done, no matter how small it is.
Well said. And we mentioned self-care. Self-care is wrapped up in a larger narrative of mental health and taking care of mental health.
And today is also the last day of Mental Health Awareness Month.
Good plug. It's true. And also, in acknowledgement of its crossover with the API Heritage Month, mental health is a very stigmatized issue in the Asian American community. It's our duty as our generation, as millennials and Gen Z, to dismantle that stigma, to be vocal and honest about conversations about psychology and how to take care of ourselves. And I think that these conversations, however acute and small, represent such an important step in changing that narrative and making sure that the people who are most at risk are seen, are cared for, and will be taken care of.
Absolutely. If you don't mind, I want to completely copy Kendrick and end with the words of Assata Shakur, which he ends every single rally with.
Let's do it.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom, and it is our duty to win. We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains.
Lacey, thank you for your words. And thank you so much for participating in this episode today. To everyone, we'll see you next time. Be safe, be vigilant, be heard. Thank you.
Thank you.